1685. 2. By the age of 5, Faith was a charming, well-behaved girl with talents all her own. She had already learned that judgment was everywhere in their world, and one should keep one's private thoughts and deeds and attributes to oneself. Her mother warned that being different could cause grief, for men often destroyed what they didn't understand. When the child asked who her father was, for surely she must have one, Maria simply said that some things were best not to know, and that, whoever he was, he had a darling child. Faith understood that theirs was a world of secrets. She told no one that she could start a fire simply by imagining a red flame, or that she could leap from the roof and land softly on the balls of her feet. She could call birds and fish to her, and because of this, she soon discovered that certain rumors in town were indeed correct. There was a serpent in Leech Lake, a large, gray-scaled, eel-like creature she soon trained to eat crusts of bread from her hand. She told no one about his existence, for already she had witnessed how men handled any creatures they deemed to be monsters. This winter, she had spied two hunters dragging a she-wolf from her den. They murdered her in the snow, along with her pup. Wolves were outlawed in the colony, and men went about killing them one by one, as they did with the native people. One of the first laws the Puritans had passed in 1630 was to place a bounty on wolves, and that included Indian dogs, which looked to be a mixture of a wolf and a fox. A black wolf's fur was worth the most, and the poor mother wolf had a coat of that color. Faith had been hidden behind the bramble bushes, her hand over her mouth, so they wouldn't hear her sobs. It was a terrible thing to have witnessed, and it changed who she was. She felt her difference tenfold, and the part of her that was human was ashamed of humankind. Another pup, overlooked by the hunters because he was so small and weak, soon emerged from the den. His half-opened eyes were silver-gray, the same shade as Faith's own, and his coat was pure black, all the better to slip through the night unnoticed. He went to Faith as if he'd known she was waiting for him, and that she could be trusted, and that they belonged to one another. Faith raced home carrying the tiny surviving pup. Maria gave Faith a leather glove filled with goat's milk for the wolf pup to drink, sucking on a hole cut in the fingertip. Faith kept the wolf in her bed that night to make sure he stayed warm. She named him Keeper, for she didn't intend to let him go. Sometime after midnight, the pup ceased whimpering, and soon they were dreaming the same dream, girl and wolf alike, a dream of blood in the snow, and of warm milk, and of a bed in which to sleep without worry or fear. In the early morning, Faith carried Keeper through the dark to the little shed where they kept two goats, and filled the glove with milk. Maria found her there once the sun had risen, asleep in the straw with the wolf by her side. She recognized a familiar when she saw one. Such a creature must always come to you on its own. You cannot choose it. It must choose you. Once it does, it will be loyal for the rest of its life, as Caden had been. Wolves are killed here, Maria told her daughter that day. But if you call the creature a dog, then a dog is what it will be. Faith nodded solemnly. She knew that people in town stared at her red hair, thought by some to be a mark of the devil's own, and gawked at her mother's red boots. Everything they were must be a secret. And the same was true for the wolf. From the very first day when Keeper was a tiny half-blind pup, he did his best to follow Faith wherever she went, refusing to be parted from her, fiercely loyal. She laughed and called him her little goat, for he soon enough ran to the goats in the barn, wishing to be fed. And he played with the tolerant creatures, biting at their hooves and running beneath them, until, having had enough, they butted him and chased him from the barn. Maria wondered if her daughter remembered the man they'd called Goat, for she still slept with the poppet doll he'd made for her. Maria had never told anyone how close Samuel Diaz had come to death, a mere breath away. Even then, he had continued to talk, as if there would never be enough time to say all that was inside of him. His stories had often seemed like imaginary tales of sea monsters and storms, but his advice to Maria had been true. He'd warned her to be careful in Massachusetts, for men would be men, especially in such a self-righteous place as Salem, and judges would continue to judge those who came before them. Once Faith had learned to read and write, Maria brought out the grimoire, their greatest secret, kept in the kitchen under lock and key, in a bureau drawer with a false bottom, so that even if someone jimmied open the drawer, they'd come upon nothing more than two large wooden spoons. "This will belong to you someday," Maria told Faith. Faith was delighted with this news. "Which day is that?" "A day when you're very grown up, and I'm a very old woman." Maria had hired a carpenter who went from town to town. He chinked the holes in the walls of the cabin, he rebuilt the shed for the goats so that it would no longer shake in the wind, and he helped Maria to lay down a path of blue stones that reminded her of Hannah's cottage. When Maria claimed there was an underground stream nearby, the carpenter had grudgingly dug their well, surprised when he hit a pool of fresh, clear water. "It's a talent to be able to find water," he told her. It was said only witches could do so, for they could not drown, and had an affinity with water that people used against them. There were those who said they could smell water, and that water had the scent of sweet iris to such women. Maria planned to pay the carpenter with the last silver coin, but instead, he asked for her help in exchange for the work he'd done on the house. He had unending headaches, and his hands had begun to shake. In time, he would not be able to earn his living. He had figured out that Maria Owens practiced the nameless art, and if she could help him, there would be no debt to pay. Maria gathered barley and vervain from her garden to boil, then wrapped the mixture in white cloth to place on the man's forehead. She said words in a language he didn't recognize, both forward and backwards, it seemed. He could not keep his eyes open, and he slept all night in the barn with the goats, without nightmare or dreams. In the morning, his head was clear. He came back to thank Maria. "You have a rare talent," he said solemnly. That was when she knew what her future would be. Maria would forsake love entirely and turn her talents to the healing arts. She lit a lantern on the porch that the carpenter had built, and then she waited. She was far from town, but the lantern could be seen by anyone wishing to venture this far. They would spy the yellow light, and then the fence, and then the garden that was carefully tended, and they would know they were welcome. A Simple Witch's Garden. Sage, for headache. Summer savory, for colic. Green wormwood, for wounds. Mix with vinegar or rum, then apply. Hyssop, for the lungs. Coltsfoot and flaxseed for coughing. Motherwort, to quiet the nerves. Sweet balm tea, for fever. Horseradish, mixed with warm vinegar for aches in the feet. Mallows, steeped in milk for dysentery. Savory, to give good fortune. Parsley, to see the future and make wise choices. The shopkeeper's wife, Anne Hatch, who had always been so kind to Maria, was the first to arrive. Anne was not more than 20, and her husband, Nathaniel, was near 50. It was not an unusual match in the colony. Men often had three, perhaps even four wives, for so many were lost in childbirth. But it was not a good marriage. Anne feared her husband, for he treated her badly. All the same, she left her bed to walk alone through the fields, turning into the dark wood to reach the cabin that many said was enchanted. People in town hadn't forgotten Maria Owens. They saw her when she came in once a month to do her shopping, the little girl tagging along with her black dog at her side. Maria always wore a blue dress and those red boots, which some people said were the color of blood, and others insisted were the color of roses. "Hold your breath when she passes by," mothers told their children. On Maria's market days, Ruth Gardner Hathorne always went to her gate to watch her, as did most of the women on Washington Street. They never spoke a word or greeted Maria. All the same, they felt drawn to this stranger. What might she do for them if they asked? What was there to be found outside their own garden gates? The magistrates had allowed Maria to own land in Essex County. Still, it was strongly recommended that no one speak to her. And if anyone should befriend her, that person would also be suspect and run the risk of an inquiry. People swore that one day there would be proof enough for her to be brought to trial for witchery. "What makes her think she can defy laws and protocol?" the women whispered among themselves. Anne Hatch went up the porch steps, even though her frantic heart was hitting against her ribs. She had been orphaned. First, her mother was taken by a fever, then her father was lost in King Philip's War. She should have been grateful to have a man pick her out of the workhouse, where she'd been sent by the overseers of the poor. But after the first night with her new husband, there was nothing to be grateful for. "Bless me," Anne Hatch whispered to he who watched over her. Her hands were shaking. "Do not judge me for what I must do," she asked of the Lord. Maria had made soap earlier that night, and the kettle was in the yard, the embers beneath burning a pale red. The brass bell sounded in the wind, and she knew someone had arrived. When she answered the door, her hair was wringing wet, for she'd just washed away the cinders with a pitcher of lake water. She wound her wet hair into a twist, which was kept in place with her silver combs. The hour was late, and her girl was in bed, but the leggy black dog growled at the visitor, who shrank back. "He's only a pup," Maria assured Anne. When she told the dog to hush, he did as he was told, curling up beside the little girl's bed. Maria had been expecting a visitor, for the broom had fallen only an hour earlier, which always meant company was coming. She had already brewed a pot of courage tea. "They know what they want," Hannah had told her. "Ask the right questions and you'll get the right answers. Even those who have been afraid to speak aloud will tell the truth when they must." "I shouldn't be here," Anne said apologetically. She looked back at the door, and for a moment it seemed she might flee. "It's late." "Perhaps it's not too late, but of course you're welcome to come or go as you like." Anne steadied herself. Once he knew she'd gone, there would be hell to pay. This was likely her only chance to escape. "I'll stay." Maria gestured to the table so they might sit together. She was not yet 22, but that was 2 years older than the unhappy young woman before her, and by now, Maria knew a thing or two about love. She understood the situation as soon as Anne removed her jacket and unclasped the hooks on the front of her dress. Anne raised her chin defiantly as she showed herself. But even before she did, Maria knew what would be revealed. Bruises in the shape of blooming flowers, the same color as the ones marking Rebecca on the day she came to see Hannah Owens. In Boston, Maria had been called upon for cures and love magic. This was something entirely different. "He does it to punish me when I'm slow or stupid," Anne said. "If I charge the wrong price or burn supper or when I speak too loudly." She had thought of murdering him in his sleep, but she hadn't the heart for such things, only the imagination. Maria gave the shopkeeper's wife a salve of calamine and balm of Gilead for her bruises, and an amulet made of blue glass beads and blue thread for protection. Anne Hatch shook her head, displeased. "This isn't a strong enough cure for my problem." The women stared at each other. To come this far alone, a woman must be willing to take a risk. What she wants, she must want, desperately. Maria wished to have nothing to do with the pains of love. Still, her heart went out to Anne. In point of fact, this wasn't love, but love gone wrong, a different story entirely. "What did you have in mind?" Maria asked. "I need poison," Anne said softly, her chin up, her eyes meeting Maria's. There were many toxic potions that could be made from the local plants. Hogweed, lily of the valley, castor bean, tansy, bittersweet nightshade, mountain laurel, yew leaf, white baneberry, henberry, horse nettle, pokeberry, pure cyanide in the pits of wild cherries. But what was done could not be undone, and vengeance always returned to its maker. "Neither one of us wants death on our hands," Maria told her. "It would come back to us and extract a price we wouldn't want to pay." Anne's eyes were swollen from crying. "How, then, am I to be rid of him?" "You have to be certain this is what you want." Maria looked over her shoulder. Faith was still sleeping peacefully. "Once he's gone, he won't return." Anne Hatch smiled then, the first smile in a very long time. She was ready to begin. Maria had Anne cut a lock of her hair to burn in a brass dish. This was the end of an old life and the beginning of a new one, and the transition must be marked. From black cloth and red thread, a small poppet was fashioned, stuffed with blackthorn and cherry bark, and then Anne's husband's name, Nathaniel, was stitched upon the cloth. Anne pierced her finger in the process, and her blood stained the cloth. But she had bled many times before on her husband's behalf. The incantation for the end of love was written on a slip of paper that she attached to a candle that burned brightly. "Let our bond be broken by the powers above. You will wish to run, and you won't look back. When I look for you, nothing will remain. You will not remember me, and you will be nothing to me." This was magic that needed words, for literary magic held the greatest power. Once home, Anne was to bury the poppet outside her front door, then burn the incantation and walk the perimeter of their property, laying down the ashes. When she went inside the house, she must dust his clothes with salt. "This will drive him away," Maria said. "Once he leaves, his fate is his own, and neither you nor I are responsible for what happens then." Nathaniel Hatch was gone for a fortnight, then a month. Before long, it was summer, and he still had not been seen. Anne ran the store herself, and after 6 months, she went to the court and was declared a widow. A search party had found her husband's boots and his gun on the far side of Leech Lake. It was thought he had drowned while hunting the sea monster, as others had before him, for there was a pile of salt near his belongings, and salt was known to call to saltwater creatures. No one but Maria had seen the footprints of his bare feet continuing on past the pond, driven by an overwhelming urge to leave Massachusetts. As a widow, without any male heirs, Anne Hatch was allowed to own property. The store was now hers. She never again charged Maria for her purchases, whether it be molasses or chicory or flour. When there were items that were difficult to come by, Spanish oranges, for instance, or myrrh oil from Morocco, luxuries that occasionally arrived when ships that had visited faraway lands docked at the harbor, Anne saved them for Maria Owens. Soon after Nathaniel Hatch disappeared, women in need of cures began to come to Maria's door, always late, when most of the good people in town were in bed. Anne Hatch's mistreatment was not as much of a secret as she had wished it to be, and it quickly became known that she'd had assistance in writing her life. In these times, most people turned to homemade remedies that could often cause more harm than good. They believed babies who died in their cradles had the life sucked out of them by Satan's emissaries or by cats, which were thought to be untrustworthy, evil creatures. They thought that the skin of an eel could cure rheumatism, and believed that beating a child who had fits with a thin switch cut from a young tree would drive the devil from his body. Now, for the sake of themselves and their children, they turned to Maria Owens for other remedies. Frustration tea, for granting good cheer, good for those who grieve. Caution tea, for wild children, such as boys who carry shotguns or dream of running off to sea. Fever tea, to nip high temperatures in the bud. Made of cinnamon, bayberry, ginger, thyme, and marjoram. Courage tea, as an antidote for fear, grief, and facing the world's trials. One cup reminds you to always be who you are. On these nights, Faith sat on her bed in the dark, with Keeper beside her, and her favorite old poppet close by as she listened to the voices in the kitchen. She quickly came to understand that her mother's visitors often came to deal with illness. And when it came to the matter of love, there were only certain kinds that Maria would approach. Love that made a woman willing to walk through the brambles late at night and beg for a remedy. As for herself, Maria never spoke John Hathorne's name. All the same, Faith knew that her mother had been betrayed by a man who was a judge. When they went to town on market days and passed the courthouse, Faith would linger behind, close her eyes, and imagine her father at his desk. John always felt a chill when she did this, and he would go to look out the window. Each time he spied her standing in the cobbled streets, he closed the shutters and turned away. "What's keeping you?" her mother would call. "Not a thing," Faith would say. But each time she grew more convinced, and by her next birthday, when she turned 6, Faith Owens had already made a vow that she would never fall in love. There was a woman who came through the fields at night, but unlike Maria's customers, she never once knocked on the door. Martha Chase didn't believe in magic, and yet she was drawn here, made to get out of her bed and walk through the fields in her nightdress. She had spied Faith Owens by the lake, running on the rocks without stockings or shoes, as if she were a wild child. She had often returned to watch Faith play, hiding behind the inkberry bushes, crying hot, salty tears. Martha wore her rope of pale hair pinned beneath a white bonnet, which she removed only once a month to wash her hair in a basin in a locked room. She'd had a husband, but he died of the spotted fever, and she had to dig his grave herself and had been quarantined for 3 months after his death. It didn't really bother her to be rid of him. He had been a cruel and distant man, and she would not miss him for a minute. If the truth be told, she'd had a fierce distaste for her husband, and had never approved of his lust and the desires that coiled and uncoiled depending on how much rum he had to drink. What tore at her was that her future seemed to die on the day of his funeral, for his absence on earth meant she would not have a child of her own. She did her best to have no pride, to follow the scriptures, and to never veer from the righteous path. But she too had a desire, one that flamed so brightly, there were times when a hole burned through her dress and singed the fabric at her chest, as if her heart could not contain what it wanted more than patience, more than obedience, more than honor, more than deliverance. She wanted a daughter. Her marriage had lasted years, and she had tried every remedy. Now she stood in the woods, lurking in the dark, as she watched the red-haired girl climb around the shore of the lake or collect vegetables in the overgrown garden, and she thought it so unfair that a witch should have what she herself wanted most in the world. Martha Chase was at the shop buying fabric for a new gray dress, for her own dresses had been washed and pressed so many times they were threadbare, when she spied the child near the bins of flour and arrowroot and loaf sugar. For an instant, she believed the Lord had heard her prayers and had delivered her heart's desire. This angel of a child she had been watching from afar as she slunk through the woods in her nightdress, for this time the girl seemed to be there all alone. She was about to go speak with her, when quite suddenly the dark-haired woman, the one people said was a witch, came down the aisle to take the child's hand. Martha felt a storm of spite rising inside. She was a plain woman, but not as simple as she proclaimed to be. She was haughty, for she believed she had been chosen to be in the Lord's light. Her jealousy was turning into a ruthless desire, and with such an emotion came a plan. The girl and her mother wore colorful dresses that Maria had sewn, with purple skirts dyed with cedar and lilac leaves, and yellow bodices tinted with bayberry leaves. They went up and down the aisles of the shop like chattering birds. There were barrels of Indian meal and rye, stored with a cold stone in the flour to keep them cool and stop them from fermenting, which could cause all sorts of maladies, including nausea and hallucinations. The girl's mother was buying beans to soak, along with a tub of local honey, some dried plum-colored currants, and a bag of flour. Martha overheard the witch tell the little girl she would fix Indian pudding, and that treat would be their supper. The witch then bought a bag of English tea at a dear price. Martha didn't waste her funds on expensive coffee beans or tea, when there were homegrown substitutes like Liberty Tea, made from loosestrife or a mixture of strawberry, currant, and sage. Some people in town were so nervous when they spied Maria Owens, they made the sign of the fox, holding up the pinky and pointer fingers of their hands to protect them. But there were women who nodded to her as if they knew her, or perhaps they merely thought it prudent to be polite. As for Martha, she said nothing. She was waiting for an omen that would instruct her on what action to take. She felt something green and bitter inside her. The seeds of jealousy had quickly grown into tendrils that circled her lungs and liver and heart. The witch left the child on her own when she went to speak with Anne Hatch, who, instead of tallying up Maria's charges, showed her a bolt of fabric that had recently come from England, an aniline-dyed calico, colorful and far superior to the homespun most women used for their clothes, perfect for a little girl's dress, if you were not a Puritan who wore gray or brown, the shades of dead leaves. "My gift to you," Anne Hatch said, clearly in a good humor, as she always was when Maria came to town. While the two women were examining the fabric, Martha went up to Faith, who was busy with a tray of buttons, counting out each one. "You're very good at numbers," Martha said. Children loved compliments, though such things could stir a child's vanity. Faith turned to the stranger. She could see inside this woman's heart and was bewildered by what she saw. There was something dark there, as if a cloud had passed over the sun. "Are you sad?" Faith asked. Martha's eyes were brimming with tears. "Of course not." She quickly wiped her tears away. She was well aware that crying in public was as shameful as wishing to steal something that didn't belong to you. "My mother could help you." To Faith, Martha seemed no different than the women who came to the door at night, leaving their shoes on the porch so they wouldn't track mud inside, women who wanted something, whose lives had not turned out as they'd imagined they would, who could not sleep or eat, who worried over the fate of a son or daughter. Faith saw a smudge around the stranger, but but she was too much of a child to understand the dark turn desire might take. Could she? Martha felt a chill. She stared at the witch, who was gathering provisions in a basket. She wore her black hair loose and red boots. A black crinoline peeked out from beneath her dress. Who was she to wear black undergarments? Martha was a widow and had worn mourning clothes for the prescribed period, then had once again dressed in a proper gray dress. And how could she do that? She asked the child, thinking to herself that the answer was simple. Witchery. It was then Maria turned and spied Martha. At once she believed that something was not right. She saw the shrewd cunning in this stranger, and the craving that was so heated a hole had burned through the bodice of her dress. There was a puff of smoke in the air that Martha caught in her hand. "Come here, Faith. Stay by my side," Maria called. The girl grinned at Martha, then ran dutifully toward her mother. "Did you want something?" Maria asked the stranger. Martha's face flushed, and her desire shone through her aflame. She wanted something most desperately. Among the town fathers, she was thought to be mild. She had been a good wife who didn't complain, and was now a widow on her own in the world. But Maria spied a woman who plotted, one who was jealous beyond words. To know another's mind was evidence of witchery, and Martha began to burn more hotly beneath Maria's gaze. "If you want something, speak up," Maria said. "I want nothing from you," Martha replied curtly. She turned on her heel and found her way to the back of the shop, fearing she would be struck dead if she dared to look behind her, for she had told a lie, and she knew it. When Maria and her daughter left, Martha went to the counter to pay for a box of glass jars she needed for her raspberry jelly. The property her husband had left her would soon be claimed by the magistrates, for she hadn't the means to cover their debt, and the land would pay for all they owed. The only thing that would grow there was a thicket of raspberry bushes. All through the summer she made jam and jelly, which she sold door to door. But every jar added to her bitterness, and every family she saw inflamed her, until at last her skin burned with a scrim of envy. "What do you think of that one?" she asked Anne Hatch, nodding to Maria as they watched her through the window. The witch was skipping alongside her daughter, as if she were a girl herself, without a care in the world, her red boots showing. There was a big black dog following them, a slinky creature with strange pale eyes. "I would consider Maria Owens to be a good and generous woman," Anne Hatch responded. "Would you now?" Martha said thoughtfully. She had her doubts about Anne as well, for where was her husband? And how had she come to be so cheerful with the burden of running the shop set upon her shoulders? Martha kept her suspicions tucked beside her desire, close to her heart, where it continued to burn. She had seen what she wanted, and she intended to have it. A daughter, one with red hair, who could already count, who skipped down the street as if she hadn't a care in the world and had no fear of strangers, even if it would have been best if she had. The letter was dispatched to the courthouse on a spring day when the pear trees had begun to bloom. The sun was shining, as it was said to do every Wednesday for at least an hour a day. There was no signature on the parchment, and the handwriting was shaky and difficult to read. It took all morning for the clerk to decipher the message, and when he did, he brought the complaint before the magistrates, who were meeting to discuss the growth of the harbor, as well as a list of grievances they must attend to: a pig delivered but not paid for, a fence constructed over the landholder's property line, the switching and caning of children in public places. The content of the letter was baffling at first, but when they really considered the charges it contained, no one was surprised this day had come. The complaint concerned a woman who flaunted the rules, who sold the bars of black soap that so many husbands had found in their wives' possession. The anonymous note accused Maria Owens of a variety of evil deeds, including speaking to spirits, dispensing poison, stealing souls, bringing on the loss of unwanted babes, and enchanting innocent men. John Hathorne was quiet during the debate among the magistrates, but his heart was racing. By the end of the afternoon, he would not have recognized the man he'd once been in Curacao. That fool had gone swimming in his clothes. He had broken his marriage vows and his vows to God. He was most certainly not the John Hathorne who threw in his lot with his fellow judges, agreeing that witchery would only lead to more witchery, and to women who believed they could do as they pleased. At the end of the day, John Hathorne stood up and declared there was reason enough to prosecute Maria Owens. That night in bed, his hands began to bleed. He rushed outside and poured water from the rain barrel over his palms, but he could not wash the blood away. In the morning, Ruth noticed that he wore gloves. Her mother had told her that this was what guilty men did after they committed a crime. They could not look at what they'd done. They hid it away from others and from themselves. But the mark was there all the same. For what was done could not be undone. There was a rapping on Maria Owens' door the following night. It was late and dark, and the frogs were singing, as they did each spring. It sounded for a moment as if Caden had returned, but when Maria woke, she saw that the flame in the fireplace burned black, and she knew there was evil outside. She stood by the door in her white nightdress, reciting a spell of protection, but whoever had come was still there. It was then that she felt the same chill she'd had when Thomas Lachlan and his brothers rode across Devotion Field with murder in mind. She took the wooden box of salt she kept in a bureau, then poured a thin line along the walls and the door. But the salt evaporated in a white cloud as soon as it was laid down. Nothing would stick. It was too late for protection. Keeper had begun to growl and scratch at the door. "Tie up that dog of yours," a man shouted. "Tell a witch to bind a wild creature, and she will do the opposite." Maria opened the window at the back of the house. "Go," she told Keeper. The wolf refused to move. He would listen to one voice alone. Faith had been woken by the ruckus, and she sat up clutching her doll, terrified by the shouting outside. "Tell Keeper to run," Maria told Faith. She knew he would fight to the death to protect the child, and she sensed the men outside would be grateful for any excuse to shoot him. "It's for his own good." Faith asked the wolf to go, and he reluctantly leapt through the window, tail between his legs. They could hear him out in the woods, howling. It was at that moment that Maria wondered if she shouldn't have sent Faith with him, as Hannah had sent her away. But it was too late to reconsider. The door was flung open by a constable with an axe in his hand, for he'd been ready to break it down. As Maria was about to utter a curse, sending them on their way, to hell if need be, the constable grabbed her, though he wailed when he did, his jabbing fingers burning from the heat of her flesh. The second constable now had the opportunity to snap iron cuffs on her wrists. This is how a witch was caught. While she was worried over her child and fought off one man, forgetting there was another. The men saw a pile of books Maria had bought while in Boston and collected them as evidence. Then Maria was taken barefoot in her nightdress with no belongings, pushed out the door into the night as her child choked back tears. "Fate is what you make it, or you will be what it makes of you." "You damn well burned me," the first constable cried. Blisters were rising on his hands where he'd grabbed her. He didn't dare touch Maria again. "You've rightly been accused." "Of what, I'd like to know," she said. Do you see how she is? Prideful, the constable muttered to his brother constable. He would have caned her then and there if he hadn't been so afraid of her powers. He did have the nerve to tear off the amulet she wore, with Caden's feather inside. And when she protested, he insisted her distress was proof of witchcraft. They led her away in chains they'd attached to the cuffs. She was informed she was being taken to the jail. In the morning, she would be brought to the courthouse. "I have a child," Maria protested. "You cannot separate us." Faith had followed them, clinging to the skirts of her mother's nightclothes. The child was very quiet and pale. She did her best to recall the remedies and enchantments she'd seen in the grimoire, but nothing suited this moment, other than one dark spell that caused flames to arise on the ground when you tossed down 6 black stones. But she had no such stones, and she was too terrified to call up any of the magic from Agrippa's occult philosophy that had been carefully transposed into the grimoire. "I don't know which words to say," she told her mother. Maria silenced her girl with a warning. "Say nothing." She could already tell that any words they spoke would be used against them, and even a child might be considered an emissary from the sinister world these men imagined to be everywhere. "They will get what they deserve." "Do you hear this witchery?" the first constable said to his brother. They stuffed their ears with grass, so they could not be further bewitched. Maria had no choice but to take Faith with her, as women who were confined to prison often did. She had once passed the jail, a small wooden building on a leafy corner of Federal Street, and had heard childish voices from within and the crying of babies. What sort of world is this? She had wondered. This second Essex County was in many ways worse than the first. As they walked on, Maria took note of a woman standing on the path, a hood draped over her head to stave off the chill of the evening. "What brings you here?" the first constable asked the woman who'd appeared in the field. "I'm just a simple neighbor," the woman said. "I cherish my town, and am here to see a good result from tonight's events." The woman now came to walk side by side with Maria. She was Martha Chase, who was at the heart of the events now conspiring. "I'm here for your sake, sister." Martha was plain and pale, and her mouth was set. But there were bright spots on her cheeks, perhaps caused by excitement or fever, or perhaps a bit of both. She threw Faith a look, and her gaze softened. "You don't want them to take the little girl as well?" Maria looked into the dark and saw silver eyes watching them. "Stay away," she told the wolf, who had hidden in the darkness. She could not stand to have Faith see her wolf's blood shed. Martha took the message for Keeper to be meant for her. "I'm only a neighbor wishing to help. The child knows me." Maria glanced at Faith and saw in the girl's eyes that it was true. "How so?" "She was in Mrs. Hatch's store. It was there we met." Faith felt that she had done something wrong in keeping their acquaintance from her mother. "She likes buttons." "Does she?" Maria took more notice and recognized the woman as the one who had been speaking to Faith. So she had wanted something after all, and Maria thought it was likely she had come to the cabin to ask for a cure. Martha introduced herself. She whispered that she was only a neighbor who wished mother and daughter well. "It's said you have powers. Can you not speak words that would free you or enchant these men?" Martha urged. "Surely you can utter a curse and stop them in their boots, be rid of them." Maria gave her a dark look. "Whoever told you that is what I do is wrong." "I mean no harm in saying so, but you don't want a little one to be taken to that filthy jail," Martha Chase said, now satisfied that Maria would not or could not defend herself by using the nameless art. "There are rats there, sister, who like nothing better than a sweet child, It's damp and cold, and many who walk in do not walk out. They had reached the field where the crows had been shot. There were sharp stones littered about that pierced Maria's feet. Or perhaps they were the thin bones of birds. She lifted Faith to carry in her arms. The girl was heavy, for she was already falling asleep, her head tucked against her mother's shoulder. "There have been children judged to have carried out witchery," Martha Chase said. "They are beaten with switches, taken from their homes, treated like common criminals." Martha had bathed in a wash of salt and vinegar that evening to make certain she washed away her desire. She was now clean, a good and serious woman with a good deed in mind. Maria had slowed down, for each step she took brought her closer to the jail. Hannah would never discuss the time when she was incarcerated, when she was believed to have a tail people said was cut off with a carving knife. Her jailers kept her naked so that they could spy her tail the moment it began to grow back. "Keep moving," the first constable scowled, expecting treachery from Maria at any given moment. He wouldn't be tricked again, and rather than touch Maria, he shoved her in between her shoulder blades with the butt of his rifle. The grass was dewy, and the hem of Maria's nightgown was soaking wet. Faith was talking in her sleep, as Samuel Diaz had been known to do, and although it was only a murmur, Maria understood her. "I want my dog. I want my bed. I want to sleep until morning." "Let me do this for you, sister." Martha placed a gentle hand on Maria's arm as she reassured her. "We are both women, and we understand a child's needs come first. Give your burden to me." A drizzle had begun, and Maria ran her hand over her daughter's damp hair. She thought of how chilly a cell would be, for the floors were dirt and the walls bare brick. They were at the edge of the field where there would soon be sunflowers. Maria could hear them growing up through the earth right now. "You must do so now while you still can," Martha said, "before we reach town and it's too late. Do so, and we can both praise God." It was dark as ash when Maria gave her daughter over to Martha's arms. Faith grumbled and Martha hushed her. Maria looked over her shoulder and saw that the wolf was following. "You'll take her dog as well," Maria urged. "She must have him." "A dog is the least of your worries." As Martha leaned in close, Maria picked up the scent of something odd, as if a fire was burning inside of this neighbor of hers. "Make it so they pay attention to your actions, and they will not pay attention to mine." They were near the homestead of the farmer who'd shot at Maria, when he believed she was a witch who could turn herself into a crow. It was here, in the field where Caden had died, that Maria threw herself onto the ground. She began to utter a curse in Latin. It would not have any effect while she had iron cuffs on, and in fact each word burned her tongue, as if the curse had been reversed, but it was successful all the same. It took attention away from Martha. The constables panicked and gathered round, careful to keep their distance, poking at her with their rifles. "Rise up now," the one in charge said. Her nightgown was stained by mud. She glanced over her shoulder as she turned, to see Martha duck behind the farmer's barn. She spied the shine of her daughter's red hair. When she arose from the ground, she glared at the constables. "You had best hope I am not practiced in black magic," Maria told the men. Later they would swear she'd had a smile on her face, and that she made the rain fall in torrents, and the toads came in masses through the mud so that the earth itself moved beneath their feet. They could see through the fabric of Maria Owen's nightgown, and soon enough they felt the devil close by, breathing on their necks, rattling their souls. When they saw her young, near-perfect body, it made them think of all they might do to her, and for that they blamed their prisoner. She was the cause of their evil thoughts, and if evil deeds followed, She was to blame as well. By then there were tears in Maria's eyes. She looked over her shoulder toward the empty field, and she saw there were indeed the sharp white bones of murdered birds in every furrow. This is the way it began. She knew that from the day Hannah told her that she must run. A woman alone who could read and write was suspect. Words were magic. Books were not to be trusted. What men could not understand, they wished to burn. They gave her nothing of comfort in her jail cell, not a blanket or a cup of water. In the morning, a woman came with porridge and a jug of water. She was a local woman named Lydia Coulson, whose 8-year-old granddaughter accompanied her. Elizabeth Coulson was a shy child who always kept her head down to conceal the fact that her face and neck were often covered with a bumpy scarlet rash that grew worse when she was nervous. Lydia had come to Maria on another occasion, desperate for a cure when her darling granddaughter had been stricken with a coughing disease that had caused her to hack up black phlegm, and Maria had given her an elixir of cherry bark and elderberry, boiled into a syrup. In time, the child had improved, and there had been no charge for the cure. Lydia had not forgotten Maria's kindness. She'd been told not to speak to the accused or to look her in the eye, but she had compassion for the prisoner and had brought her a loaf of bread hidden in her granddaughter's shawl.
"Will you return the favor I once did for you?" Maria begged. "All I ask is that you make certain my daughter is well."
When Lydia Coulson agreed to do so, Maria took her hand. She asked her for one more favor, that she bring a book for her to write in, along with pen and ink. "You can hide it in little Elizabeth's shawl." Later in the week, Lydia returned. She hadn't yet managed to see Faith, but she was able to smuggle in a blue paper journal. In return for this favor, Maria had Lydia bring her granddaughter back into the cell. Once the child and her grandmother were there together, Maria told Lydia to draw a circle of protection around them. Maria was bound by iron, so she had Lydia recite an incantation Hannah had taught Maria, which called for good fortune and good health. When Lydia and her granddaughter left the jail that day, the blotchy rash that had always plagued the little girl had disappeared, and her skin was clear and fresh. They were silent in the light of this miracle, and when anyone asked, little Elizabeth's grandmother said the child had fallen asleep in the woods, with her face resting on weeds, that it had a healing property. Once she was alone in her jail cell, Maria began to write in her journal. She did so with her cuffs in place, biting at her skin. She kept the book hidden behind a loose brick. She wrote for the future, for her daughter, and the granddaughter she might have one day. "Beware of love. Know that for our family, love is a curse. He should have been my enemy. Instead, I thought I fell in love with him, and I made the mistake of declaring my love. I was wrong to think that was love. I was too young to know any different." The constable's wife was brought in to cut off Maria's black hair with a rusty tool she used to shear sheep. Hair was known to make women powerful, and in fact, Maria moaned as if in pain while the constable's wife cut her hair so short that her scalp shone through. Then she was paraded through town to the courthouse in the sharp sunlight. Maria was still in her muddy nightdress, wearing nothing underneath. Men and young boys came to stare, although when she stared back, they quickly glanced away, mortified and shocked by their own dark thoughts. Maria remained in chains, and by now her wrists were bleeding, yet she'd managed to write all night until there was no longer any ink. The courthouse on Endicott Street was built of granite brought down from the cliffs of the White Mountains. Maria was chained to her seat to face three magistrates. John Hathorne was among them, and she hoped that he would not act against her, and that what they'd once had would fill his heart with compassion. But when he looked past her as if she didn't exist, she knew she was alone here. Maria was asked her name and her date of birth, both of which she gave freely. And then she was asked the name of her husband, to which she replied, "None." The letter the court had received was then read aloud, accusing her of all manner of evildoing, including turning herself into a crow who flew above the fields, and a succubus who stole the souls of men. In spite of herself, Maria laughed. "Does this list of evil amuse you?" the oldest magistrate asked. "I find it to be ridiculous." She turned to John, who looked away. "Some among you know these are lies," she dared to say. "Do women not come to you for potions?"
"For herbs to cure illness, yes."
"For magic, for vengeance, for spells, for the devil's work?"
"No."
She was freezing, as if a block of ice had been set upon her. Even now, John said nothing.
"I'm a healer."
"Did you not think of enchanting the sheriffs who came for you and consider killing them?" she was asked. But these were not questions. She understood that now. They were statements of facts in these men's eyes. This is the way it must have begun for Hannah, with lies, with fear, with a man who refused to look at her.
"I did not, sir," she managed to say.
"Speaking falsely is a sin, you understand," she was told. One constable had sworn he had a bite mark on his shoulder. The other had been in a fever since he'd touched her.
"Treating someone falsely is a sin as well," Maria glared at Hathorne. He must have felt her eyes upon him, for at last he returned her glance. It was as though they had never met.
"Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live," the old magistrate said, quoting from Exodus.
It was the same quote used on the title page of The Discovery of Witches, written by Matthew Hopkins, who had overseen the deaths of so many in the first Essex County in England. A woman in disguise was called into the room. She'd been covered in a veil that reached to the floor to hide her identity. As a witness against Maria, she had pleaded to remain anonymous, fearing for her life. To turn against a witch was dangerous business, and her pleas had been answered. When she was seated before the council, she was to respond by nodding, so that Maria would not know her by her voice and curse her. Without the iron cuffs, Maria would have known her in an instant through the use of sight, but now this enemy of hers might have been any woman in town. The veiled witness nodded yes to enchantments, yes to a promise of murder, yes to curses, yes to sexual perversities, yes to speaking with the devil. Had she seen her fly? Yes, indeed she had. Had she seen feathers fall away and flesh appear to cover the witch's bones? Yes, as well. Black plumes sprouting upon her skin? Yes, 1,000 times, yes. "You are a liar," Maria said before she could stop herself, "and you will pay for these lies." "Are you threatening witchery right here before us?" the chief magistrate asked. "Where is her proof?" Maria wished to know.
"Her proof is the word of a God-fearing woman."
Maria sat back in her chair. Hannah had told her how God-fearing people had nailed her cat to her front door while it was still alive, how they had given her moldy bread and no water in jail, how she'd been stripped and searched to see if she had a tail. Already the metal cuffs had drawn blood on Maria's wrists, black blood that was burning through the wooden floor. "Let no one see it. Let no one know," Hannah had warned her, should her fate ever lead her to a prison cell. "Do not speak or argue. Do not proclaim your innocence. They want you to be guilty. They want to mock your sins. They want to keep you in irons. And they would most certainly like to see you burn."